Furious Artists, so you can go to the opening for more than just the snacks.
The Oshima Gang is an exhibition by Theo McDonald currently showing at Room Gallery. McDonald is a Tamaki-based interdisciplinary artist with a focus on still and moving documentary photography and cinematography to explore his interest in public expressions of militarism, national identity, and collective and personal memories. As an experimental documentary, The Oshima Gang sees McDonald revisiting five colonial institutions in Tamaki Makaurau that were featured in Japanese filmmaker Nagisa Oshima's Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, which came out in 1983. Using fukuron, or landscape theory, as a mode of cinematic communication, layering Super 8 film with archival text and raw production audio, McDonald uses these sites of colonial architecture to invite viewers to consider and critique our identity in Tamaki Makaurau, placing historical ideas, documents, and international relationships in dialogue with our present. I had a kōrero with Theo McDonald about the Oshima Gang and these thematic interests that underpin his practice.
I'm Theo McDonald. I'm a sort of interdisciplinary artist, I guess. I've worked across a lot of different mediums, maybe with a focus on video, photo, and a bit of a background in performance, which I'm not doing so much anymore, but I think continues to really inform the shape of what I do and the kind of research projects I pursue. You know, that idea of being a body in space. And a lot of the work I do is around, in particular the last few years, kind of thinking about foreign policy and diplomacy and really those points where something that is kind of written in, you know, written in government legislature becomes real, like that threshold where it actually touches the lives of, I guess, quote-unquote, normal people. So I recently, a few projects I've done recently, one was looking at this town in Japan which had a friendship city relationship with One Tree Hill Borough before it was part of Auckland City. And that was a kind of diplomacy project that they'd done in the 80s and kind of looking at how that had dissipated over 40 years. And then another project, which was a video I made for a show at the Douse called Cujo 2. The work was called Cujo 2. The show was called The Brood. And that was thinking about trying to get my dog back into New Zealand from Canada through biosecurity during COVID. And again, that thing of when legislature becomes real, those kind of touch points.
Yeah, I guess I'm interested to see how that kind of relates to this current exhibition. The Oshima Gang at Room Gallery revisits these five sites of colonial significance in Tamaki Makaurau, constructed between the 1850s and 1930, the Auckland Railway Station, King's College, Auckland Council Chambers, Mount Eden Prison, and the Auckland Domain Winter Gardens. Each of these sites were filming locations featured in Nagisa Oshima's 1983 film Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. When did you kind of first come across this film, and then what was kind of the impetus or inspiration to kind of begin taking on this experimental documentary?
So the film itself I became aware of about 10 years ago. I did a series of performance works in 2015 where I guess embodied David Bowie for 3 months. So the idea was kind of, the idea was really focusing on his period in 1983 when he'd been like promoting the Let's Dance album and touring around, you know, this massive global tour, his first kind of real pop star success, you know, after being, I guess, more of a kind of alternative musician essentially. And so I bleached my hair and I wore this suit for 3 months. I did a series of performance videos, some of which you can see online if you look them up on Circuit, the New Zealand sort of moving image database. And so that was something I'd sort of first seen then, this film that was made here, which, you know, was interesting to me. And at the time, I was also interested in the fact that Bowie had performed at Western Springs and it was the largest, in one of those weird sort of per capita-y sort of ways, it was the most popular concert of all time in the Southern Hemisphere at Western Springs, and people had famously like pushed down the fences and lit fires in the hills. So this kind of, you know, big moment. So that was when I first encountered Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. And then in the 10 years since then, my practice has kind of moved around a bit and kind of, yeah, developed into more of this kind of interest in, I guess, kind of political history, political movement. But I am really interested, I guess, in those moments when New Zealand interacts with, like, the rest of the world.
Mm.
There's a famous Damien Wilkins essay called When Famous People Come to Town, which, you know, is always being... And it's kind of a compendium of quotes and recollections from, like, you know, when Mark Twain came to New Zealand, like, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And, so again, those kind of contact points are really interesting to me. And then also what I found quite compelling about Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, was that it was made in New Zealand in this period that's kind of talked about as the tax shelter period of New Zealand filmmaking. So this four-year block where the Muldoon government introduced really good tax benefits for international productions to kind of juice up the film industry.
Mm.
And maybe there's a bit of a kind of, you know, relevance to that, because we've seen sort of three waves of that in the last 40 years, right? Like, there was this wave where, you know, something like 80 films got made here in the early 80s.
Mm.
And then there was the whole Lord of the Rings thing, you know, where suddenly, you know, kind of Weta became this big global player. And then there's been the last 5 years when COVID meant that so many productions got made here, you know, movies like X and shows like Cowboy Bebop. So that kind of, yeah, relationship between culture and diplomacy and financial movement. The New Zealand merchant bank that sort of, what do you call it, backed, you know, financed, backed the finances of Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, was the Broadbank, which was, you know, it's not something people kind of talk about a lot now, but it was led by Don Brash. So again, it's these kind of histories that they all, you know, they're still so relevant and kind of, you know, when you think about where someone like Don Brash comes from, that's where he comes from.
Yeah.
Like, that's the kind of, you know, it seems like it's about one thing, but it's actually about a lot of things.
That's so interesting. I guess, like, film has, like, and New Zealand being, like, a film location has had such an impact on, like, the way we're viewed internationally. I think, like, we have so many people coming here, like, to see Lord of the Rings things, and, like, it's really kind of culturally put us on the international stage, so that's interesting things to think about.
Yeah, I think it is very interesting to think about what our kind of, you know, national identity is. What do we kind of coalesce around? Obviously, there's different answers for different people, but you think about, you know, being in BFM, you think about something like Flying Nun as, like, a real point of pride for a lot of people. And as an artist and someone who's working with photo and video, which, you know, lens-based, and they have that relationship to documentary, I'm interested in images, like the sort of images that capture the way we think about living here. And I'm also really interested in the fact that although a third of the population live in Auckland, we really very rarely see Auckland as Auckland in local productions. You know, like, every indie film, and no shade against indie films because there are lots of reasons for that, but, you know, I mean, think about The Weed Eaters recently. So many New Zealand independent films are about some people who live in the city who go to the country. And it begins with them going to the country and then something happens.
Yeah.
And so many people live in cities. What is that experience? If you want to know what that experience is, sometimes you might see a representation of it in a international co-production set during World War II in Indonesia.
Yeah.
Like Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. Or, you know, I always love when you see a movie and then at the end it pops up, filmed on location in New Zealand, and you're like, wait.
Wait, no way.
Yeah, where? Where did that happen? When did that happen?
Yeah, no, it was interesting reading a bit more about this work. I think it was on Tituhi's website and your writing for that show, where you were talking about how, like, a lot of people living in Japan at the time, like, watching the film, like, didn't even clock that that might have been New Zealand, and, like, that they just thought it was Indonesia and didn't even think twice that it would have been filmed here.
There's a sort of interesting history with Japan's relationship to tourism and also New Zealand, where, you know, in Japan, workers didn't really take holidays for a long time. Like, that was something that was brought in quite deliberately. I might have the years slightly wrong, but I believe at the end of the 70s, like, that encouragement to take holidays. And that's also when New Zealand started seeing an uptick, like, quite a dramatic rise in Japanese tourism, which is also, you know, what kind of led to these sibling city relationships and these kind of, you know, diplomatic ties being forged. And in many ways, Japan and New Zealand are very similar countries. You know, they're both volcanic. They both have, like, if you go up to Hokkaido in the north of Japan, there's the dairy industry. Like, there's lots of crossover. And sometimes I think, you know, if you take two photographs of Japan and New Zealand taken in the right kind of rural setting, you could kind of, you know, trade one for the other or mistake one for the other. Yeah, and I think it's also that idea that you live in a city that is very commonly doubling for another place, I think is also, there's something unsettling about that. I've been working with, for the exhibition, the writer Oscar Mardell has prepared a sort of response text, and so we've been going back and forth about that for the last week, and he really hones in on, I guess, this idea of Auckland as a haunted city. Because again, that sort of, you know, those stories you tell about the place you live are quite important in terms of how you really reckon with them. And sometimes I'm not sure what the stories are that we do tell about Auckland. Like, you know, there are a few key stories that are, you know, very important and do get told. But all of these layers of construction and architecture that it feels like we just have to keep reminding ourselves of. Like, you know, there was that book a few years ago, Rock College, that told the history of Mount Eden Prison. And, like, you think about, like, these are substantial histories. Yeah.
For sure. Coming back to, like, the film itself, I found the blend of contemporary and archival footage and audio in the film really interesting, like, where we see these contemporary snippets of today's world, modern cars and trains, juxtaposed with the use of Super 8 film and the subject of these old colonial sites. And even just in the choice to revisit these sites, like, over 40 years after Oshima's film's release, how do you kind of see the relationships between the film, these locations, and our perception of them today?
I think there's an interesting relationship where maybe our perception of these sites hasn't really changed that much in the last 40 years. Like, the reason they were used in that film is because they could stand in for the early 20th century. You know, in the context of the film, King's College doubles as a South African boarding school, and, you know, we're presume the sort of 1920s, 1930s, 1920s. And so going back there now in a kind of superficial way, not a lot has changed. But then on the other hand, one of the sites that was filmed there that I tried to find, the person who was helping me at King's College tried as much as she could to look for it and concluded that it had likely been knocked down in the subsequent 40 years. And then on the other hand, one of the sites I filmed was a pond in the film, and it's quite a key set piece in the film, and that's now been covered up and it's been turned into these quite interesting sort of, I think of them as kind of like a pig run, and it's used to, like, shepherd the boys into the dining hall. I mean, I grew up in Wellington, so I'd never been to King's College until now, until this project. I hadn't been to Kawo Island, which is also something. I think, you know, these are places that if you grow up here, you're far more likely to have gone on, like, I mean, you might go to Kawo on, like, a field trip.
Yeah, I think my year 10 camp was there or something. Yeah, maybe intermediate, actually.
When we were there, we saw, like, a whole group of children gathered on, like, on a pier waiting for the boat to pick them up from school
Classic.
Camp.
Classic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think, and that kind of, yeah, there's a sort of theory of filmmaking which proposes, and I guess a theory of photography, that, you know, the emotional pull of these things is in that tension between history and the present, right? That you're looking at a historical image in the present, that there's this kind of movement happening. There's this Japanese photographer, Takuma Nakahira, who was involved with kind of some of the sort of theoretical underpinning of this project, that's and he talked about this idea of, like, you know, when he holds a photograph, there is history between, in the space between his eyes and the image he's holding. And I think there is something of that, where using Super 8 to film these locations was very much about trying to just really foreground that feeling of history, but also the unreliability that, you know, if you look at these things, until you see a contemporary train burst through the image, you could very easily believe that you're looking at footage from the 80s. And that kind of slippage is something that I think invites a kind of speculation on how we historicize the place we live.
Totally. In terms of format, you've used a method informed by this concept of Fukairon, or landscape theory, which emerged in Japan following the collapse of the 1960s student protest and was also once employed by Oshima as well. Are you able to speak a little as to what that format entails and why you thought it suited this project?
Fukairon was this kind of very short-lived, like, kind of flare-up of debates and filmmaking in the late 60s in Japan that was premised on this idea that basically the late 60s student protests had failed. It had been, you know, sort of 2-year period of mass protest against Japan's remilitarization and kind of joining of the Western military bloc, which is obviously something that we can very much relate to now. It's very relevant. In terms of like remilitarization, I mean, you know, just this week with the summit in China, like that just feels incredibly relevant. And then also, it's also something of a threshold, you know, it's not just this flare up, it's also after the Fukuron debates, the participants all go in these different directions and they remain very political filmmakers. And I think as an artist here, it can be, you know, we don't have a huge history of filmmaking. As an artist who's working with film, we don't have a huge history of kind of options because we have such a small population. And so I think often you do look abroad, and I saw this thing and I saw that it had kind of got this resonance here, because in the same way that Japan is a nation with a long history of discourse on the meaning of its landscape, you know, going back to, you know, going back hundreds of years, Japanese poets and thinkers have sort of contested and argued about what the Japanese landscape says about the Japanese people. There's a writer, Shusaku Endo, who's a 20th century writer, but he was a Catholic writer, and he sort of talked about the idea that the fen bog of Japan was not able to host Christianity, which is a whole tangent. But the point is that theorization of landscape is something that Japan has this long history of, and that we have this long history of, right? Like, in an art history context, you can talk about Francis Pound, but beyond that, you can talk about, you know, Michael King grapples with that, Anne Solomon grapples with that. Like, it's one of the, when we are a nation where people come to for the landscape and talk about the landscape is this incredibly political subject. And Fukuron is also very much about that tension between an urban reality and a rural fantasy. That Japanese people, by the reading of, you know, the Fukuron critics, were still, and the government, were still perpetuating this kind of myth of the rural society, even though most people were living kind of itinerant labour in urban environments, which, you know, I mean, yeah, again, you don't need to stress it too much, it resonates. And as a kind of sidebar, you know, also one of the filmmakers, one of the key filmmakers, Adachi Maseo, you know, he went and joined the Japanese Red Army, which was, you know, affiliated with the Palestinian Liberation Front. And Fukuron has kind of found new purchase in the last 15 years as people have been talking about these kind of, you know, colonial occupations, that idea of how can we think about the landscape as this political thing, and both the rural and the urban in relation.
I guess as an extension of that, like, that's your methodology, but in terms of process, are you able to talk me through a little bit more about your making process with this film? How did you go from turning your ideas into the final product?
Yeah, very slowly. It's taken about 2 years, and a lot of that has been to do with these kind of processes of access, basically. You know, I had specific ideas about how I wanted to film these landscapes, urban landscapes, you know, which entailed being able to get permission to be in these sites, you know, at certain times of day, like wanting to be there kind of early, and also wanting to kind of film them without kind of impinging on people's ability to access them. So if you see the film, there's a kind of variety of wide shots of these sites and then detail images. And some of them, you know, I mean, King's College and the apartments at the Auckland Railway Station are private, you know, and then Winter Gardens is public, but I had to go through Screen Auckland. So there's all those sorts of things that just kind of developed this method of getting in places, getting toured around them, taking a lot of preparation shots, shooting on Super 8, which means you have, you know, sort of 2.5 minutes to a cartridge. Luckily, I was full-time employed when I was filming the bulk of the film. It's so expensive to shoot on Super 8. And I was very lucky to also, I got some, I got a residency in Tokyo through the Auckland Festival of Photography, which was really supportive and allowed me to kind of, again, just keep working on this thing. And then I was working with Ian Powell at Reversal Cine, and Ian was developing and scanning the film, sending it to me, and I've just been slowly kind of cobbling together this edit as I've shot new material for about 2 years now, But yeah, very research-based. And I sort of had this general idea of what was in the film. You know, some of the signs you can clearly recognise. You know, if you see the railway station in Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, it just looks like the railway station. And whereas others, when I was in Tokyo, I went to the National Film Archive of Japan and was able to access this huge amount of all these archival resources about the making of the film that they have there as part of the kind of Nagisa Oshima gift. You know, he died about 10 years ago. And that really filled in a lot of those gaps in terms of where things had been filmed that weren't so easy to find out. Like, for example, Kawo Island Mansion House is a site that was filmed but cut out of the film. And again, that's kind of interesting and maybe demonstrating the shaping of a picture of a place. You know, editing is everything, right?
Showing alongside this film in the room, archive room, is another film, Tokyo Landscape War Memorial, in which the viewer sees a remake of a key repeated scene in another of Oshima's films, The Man Who Left His Will on Film. Do you want to speak a little to this work as well, and I guess the connection between the film and this project?
Yeah, so in the Fukuron debates, there are kind of two key films that come out of it. And they're both made very quickly. And they're AK Serial Killer and The Man Who Left His Will on Film. And The Man Who Left His Will on Film was maybe the more literal expressions of the kind of politics surrounding that moment, where it's about a group of student protesters, the kind of cultural wing of the, you know, revolution project, who are kind of distraught about the fact that the revolution has failed. And one of them at the very start of the film, who has the camera, jumps off a building, and when they process this film, they find that it's just these seven static shots of kind of generic Tokyo suburbs. And that was directed by Nagisa Oshima, who then came to Aotearoa to make Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, you know, 10 years later. And so it felt to me like the relationship between the two films I've made, one of which is really looking at Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, one of which is looking at The Man Who Left His Will on Film, which was filmed as Tokyo Landscape War, or after the Tokyo Landscape War, hence Tokyo Landscape War Memorial. The relationship between the two is this kind of, I guess, more reflexive thinking on what it means to bring, to kind of import a methodology to this country. And, you know, I think there is a criticism you could make of this project for being like, well, what relevance does that have here? You know, why are you importing this external history and language of art making? And I think that's a really interesting subject. And it kind of applies to the same question of, you know, why do we let international producers rather than people from abroad, why do we let international companies make movies here? Shouldn't we be making movies here about us? Because we don't have that. And I mean, like Lindsay Shelton, who was heavily involved with the Film Commission and its like founding, who's a film programmer. He lives in Wellington. He's written a really good book about the history of New Zealand film. And he talks about how he kind of had this fantasy in the 70s and 80s that New Zealand would become the Sweden of the South, where like we would have a really, you know, robust domestic film production that would tell stories for and by New Zealanders and in this whole variety, this, you know, plurality of experience. And you could go into the cinema and you would have like your pick of like, you know, six different domestic films. And he saw Vincent Ward at the time as the kind of Ingmar Bergman of that. And then he said that when Peter Jackson arrived, it was like a freight train just coming through and it changed the entire thing. And so when you think about that, I guess that, yeah, that question of who is served, obviously, the, you know, the government likes to tell us that we are economically served by international productions. And obviously there are lots of people that it's fantastic that they get that work. But there is also the question of kind of, in the same way that you need to have a BFM, what is the BFM for film? Very roundabout answer.
That was artist Theo McDonald speaking to me about the Oshima Gang, an experimental documentary exhibition currently showing at Room Gallery. The exhibition is on until the 11th of October.